All right, folks, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another week, another edition of the Daily Power Parsha. It is great to be here with you on this fine Monday afternoon. Stephanie, welcome. It's great to have you here. All right, so we begin a new Torah portion and a discussion, and these Torah portions are very episodic. They're very, very dramatic, very engaging. We actually have a continuation of a story from last week, all the way at the end of last week's Torah portion. We read about the nefarious plot of Balaam. Balaam was, of course, the evil prophet who was hired to curse the Jewish people and to bring about their spiritual downfall through, you know, his powers, and he did have powers. He was not successful in that regard, but as I mentioned Friday, he was successful in another area equally as nefarious, and that is that before he left, disappointed from his attempts to curse the Jewish people through his spiritual powers, he gave advice to Balak, the king of Moab, and he said to Balak, essentially, send the young women, send your young women to entice the Jewish men into immodest behaviors, and when they act in an immodest way, then God will not be happy with them, and that will cause displeasure and bring about some sort of punishment, negative repercussion, etc. And that's exactly what happens. What happens is that the nation of Moab and Midian, they both send out the forces to entice the Jewish men. Some Jewish men are engaged in immoral behavior. The next thing you know, a plague breaks out, and the plague takes a number of the Jewish people. So I'm going to share my screen with you in just a moment. Give me a second here to pull this up. To give you a number count, literally the last words of last week's Torah portion, the plague raged and then it ceased. We'll talk about how it ended in a moment. A total of 24,000 died in the plague. Those are literally the last words of the previous Torah portion, that 24,000 people died in the plague. So it's not an insignificant number. It's a very significant number, 24,000. So how does the plague end? The plague begins due to immorality. How does it end? It ends when a man named Pinchas takes his spear and takes the life of a Jewish prince and a Midianite princess who were engaged in a semi-public display of immorality. So, give me a second here. Yeah. So we have Zimri ben Salui. We'll read him. We'll read his name inside in a moment. Zimri was the Jewish leader, and Cozbi, who was a princess from the nation of Midian, she was the other participant, and it was going on. It was a public, semi-public display, and it was terribly immoral and just not a good thing. So Pinchas, the background of the story is Pinchas goes to Moses and he says, Moses, Moshe, we got to do something about this. What do we do? And Moshe, he delayed, he hesitated. And Pinchas said, didn't you tell us that in these extreme rare circumstances where we have public acts of transgression in the realm of immorality? You know, immorality is, adultery is one of the three cardinal sins where we're told that we're supposed to give up our lives and not transgress. Usually we give up our lives if the mitzvah comes in contradiction to life and death. For example, you know, you violate Shabbos in order to save a life. It's not violating Shabbos, it's saving a life. So Shabbos goes away, but certain things you don't do. Murder, you don't do to save a life. You don't kill someone to save your own life. You can't do that. It's not okay. Unless they're coming to kill you, then it's not murder, it's self-defense, but that's an exception. But if you can't murder to save a life, you can't engage in a moral relationship to save a life, nor in idolatry to save life. So those are the three cardinal sins. And here this person was engaged in one of the cardinal sins in, a semi-public display, and he was a leader of the tribes. It was a terrible situation. So Pinchas says to Moshe, didn't you tell us that in these certain circumstances, a zealot is permitted to go ahead and take their lives, to put an end to it and put an end to the plague? And Moshe says, yes, you're right, you reminded me. Moshe, on some level, forgot that ruling. Moshe said, if you're the one that remembers it, so you be the one to meet it out. The one who, and there's an Aramaic expression, I'll translate it in English, it's basically said, our sages in the Talmud and the Medrash, they phrase it in an Aramaic language, but basically Moshe said, the one who reads the letter should be the one to fulfill its statement. So you be the one to do it, and he does it. He takes a spear, and he ends up spearing the two participants, and that puts an end to the plague. So that takes us directly into this Torah portion. So let's jump right in. Actually, hold on one second. Let me get it up on my screen. And now let me share my screen, and hopefully this will come up. Okay, can you guys see that? The Torah portion? Yes? Okay, great. So let's begin. Oh, I don't know why they do this. I still haven't figured out the whole English naming construct. Okay, I'm going to go, listen, I'll do Moses, because I'm used to that. I'm not going Phinehas. Not happening. I'm going Pinchas on that guy, all right? The main character of today's narrative is going to be Pinchas. I'm giving you the original name, because it's too complicated for me to say the English version. Okay, this is Numbers chapter 25, verse number 10, and this is the beginning of this Torah portion, this week's Torah portion. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen. So, look at this. Look at his lineage, which I didn't mention so far. His lineage is, he's the son of Elazar, who was the oldest remaining son of Aaron, who was the high priest. And remember last week's Torah portion, the first of the two, Aaron passes away. So the high priest Aaron passed away, gave over. Remember, he dressed his son in his clothes. Elazar became the high priest. This is now Elazar's son Pinchas. So he's a grandson of Aaron. Essentially, he's Moses. Let's figure this out. Not his nephew. His great nephew. Is that a thing? Great nephew? Yes? All right, his great nephew. He wasn't just a nephew. He was like the great nephew. Okay, so let's continue reading. So Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen, Mendel. No bouncing. Has turned my anger away from the children of Israel by his zealously avenging me among them so that I did not destroy my children of Israel because of my zeal. Basically, he's saying that Pinchas stopped what could have been a much greater disaster by ending the act. Oh, I probably should have mentioned, when Pinchas skewers shish kebabs, whatever, I don't mean to make light of it, the two individuals that were middle of their activities, of their extracurricular activities, that put an end to all of the other activities that were also happening at the same time. Just that I'd mention. Okay. So look at the ramification or the outcome. Therefore, God says to Moses, say, tell him, I hereby give him my covenant of peace. Briti shalom. God says, I'm giving Pinchas my covenant of peace. Verse 13, it shall be for him and for his descendants after him as an eternal covenant of kahuna. The big kahuna, he's giving him the priesthood because he was zealous for his God and atoned for the children of Israel. So with this, the Torah is telling us, Pinchas earns the priesthood. Now you might be wondering, if Pinchas was the son of Elazar, who was the son of Aaron the Kohen, so wasn't he already a priest? The answer is no, he was not a priest. Why was he not a priest? Because the priesthood was given initially to Aaron, and to Aaron's sons. He had four sons, Nadav and Avihu, who passed away, and Elazar and Itamar. So it was given to Aaron and his two remaining sons. And it was then given to any other member of the family that would be born after that point in time. So it was given to Aaron and his sons and anyone else, any grandsons that would then, at from that point, be born. Well, Pinchas was already born as a grandson. Pinchas was a grandsoned in, if you will, but not in that way. He was a grandson that was born prior to the appointment of the priesthood. He didn't get the priesthood because that was directly from God, because that was only given to Aaron and his sons, and he wasn't the son, he was a grandson. He didn't get it as being a grandson born after that, or a great-grandson being born after that, because he was already born. See, he was in that kind of that middle generation where his father and grandfather were priests. His younger siblings could have been priests, but he missed out on it. So God says, because he did this action, I'm going to give him the kuna, I'm giving him the priesthood. You should know the priesthood is always associated with peace. Peace and love. And I think the interesting thing here, I'm not going to say it's ironic, but it's interesting. The interesting thing here is that he does something that on the surface seems to be not peaceful at all, right? What is he doing on the surface? He's taking lives. So that seems to be a violent, or not seems to be, it is on some level a violent act, a not peaceful act. And yet, the reward or the consequence of it is that he becomes a Kohen and receives the covenant of peace, which kind of tells us something that's important. And I think it's something that we need to all remember. And that is, you might be peace-loving, but sometimes you have to be able to defend what you hold dearest, right? Just because you believe in peace and love doesn't mean that you don't have strength. If God forbid you have a peace-loving person, and God forbid somebody, that's not the God forbid, if you have a peace-loving person, and God forbid somebody breaks into their house, you would hope that the peace-loving person would do whatever they needed to do to protect their family. Right, because although they believe in peace and love for everybody, they also have an obligation to protect their family. So we have here is in a sense Pinchas acting zealously to protect his family. Here we have 24,000 of his brothers and sisters, or maybe just brothers. I think maybe only the men died. Probably only the men died because they were the ones acting in this way. So 24,000 of his brothers that are dying in this plague because of this activity. He needs to put an end to it. There's only one way to do it, and he does it. So is it an act of violence? No, the Torah traces his lineage. He's the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, and his covenant is peace, peace and love. Aaron, we said, is always associated with love and bringing people together. Sometimes, because of our love, we have to act in a way that's swift and decisive. Like I said last week, the message here is not to carry a spear with you, you know, just in case. That's not the message. The message is not a direct, you know, takeaway yet. You know, act zealously. The message is we have to love the things that are worth loving. And if you really love the things that are worth loving, then you're going to defend those things, you know, and to whatever extreme you need to defend it. So, for example, if you have something you really believe in, a value that you believe in, and that value is coming under attack, or that value is... Let me come in and text. If someone's trying to pull away that value from you, so you fight it and you say, no, don't pull it away from me. It's my value. It's, you know, when it comes to Jewish values or moral values, ethical values, things that we need to defend with all of our strength, recognizing that that's not a sign. In other words, being peaceful should not be associated or conflated with weakness. You know, because a person believes in peace and love, therefore they have no backbone. Those are two different things. You can believe in peace and love and have a backbone. Pinchas had a backbone. He did something that was required to do at that moment. And that's it. Okay, let's continue inside. The name of the Israelite who was killed, who was slain with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu. So we're naming names here. I mean, this is like not being brushed under the carpet, under the rug. This is, you know, straight up naming names. So Zimri is the Jewish leader. He was the chieftain of the Simeonite paternal house. Shimon, one of the tribes, the second son of Jacob was Shimon. So from the Simeonite house, he was the chieftain. And what about his partner in crime, if you will? The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Tzur, a national leader of a paternal house in Midian. So he was a leader, she was a leader. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, there's a medrash. Maybe I'll pull it up in Rashi. Let's see if Rashi says something here. Hold on. No. No. By the way, look at this. Look at this Rashi right here. The reason why the Torah tells us that she was a princess is to inform you of the hatred of the Midianites toward Israel, for they submitted a princess to prostitution to entice Israel into sin. In other words, you would think maybe the princesses they wouldn't send to. No, it doesn't matter. She was from a prominent family, a princess, privileged family. Doesn't matter. They were going after. If I'm not mistaken, though, the Medrash says something even more, that she came in and she said, "I'm a princess. Take me to the greatest leader." And so they were thinking, who should she be introduced to? Moses? Or if I'm not mistaken, it was Zimri who said, "No, I'm prominent enough. Bring her to me." So he was like, ran after her on a certain level. Anyway, just a lot of really just very troubling, fascinating, disturbing on all levels. It's a very interesting story. Another point about the story that I need to mention is the fact that Moshe didn't respond. When, as I mentioned before, Pinchas, I'm going to stop sharing for a moment. Pinchas asks Moshe, "What should we do?" And I said before, Moshe freezes. And then Pinchas says, "Well, didn't you teach us such and such?" And Moses says, "Yeah, thanks for reminding me. Go ahead and do it." So the question is, why did Moshe forget? Why did he forget? What's the deeper significance of him forgetting? There's a beautiful teaching that the Rebbe applies to this. And he says, the moral of the story is sometimes something needs to be done and no one's stepping up to the plate. And you might say, how come no one's acting? We have great people, great leaders, great scholars, great rabbis, great community people, great other people. Who am I? I'm just a regular, person. We have all these great people and they're not doing anything. So I guess if they're not doing anything, then nothing should be done. Pinchas doesn't rest on his laurels and say, look, Moshe's around. If something should happen, let Moses take care of it. Who am I? I'm just Pinchas. I'm not even a Kohen. I'm kind of this, middle generation. I'm nothing. I don't have any titles to my name. No letters after my name. So why should I do something? The Rebbe says, no, Pinchas saw a problem. He saw a wrong. And he was committed to righting the wrong, even if no one else was doing anything about it. There's something called the bystander effect. I'm sure you've heard of it, right? The bystander effect, where if you have a group of people and something goes awry, someone's in danger, the more people you have, the less chance, the more likely it is that no one's going to do anything. Why? Because everyone will say, let the other person do it. It's like the joke that they tell about a town that had exactly 10 people for the minyan. So every week they had 10, they had a minyan. Everyone showed up and they had a minyan. So one week the word gets out that a new family comes to town. A new family moves to town. And now you have 11. From that point on, there was never a minyan, right? Because at that point, everyone said, let the other guy show up. So no one showed up, maybe except for the new guy. But that's it. So when you know you have to, say you have to. But as soon as you can let someone else take care of it, then no one takes care of it because everyone says, let the other guy do it. So the Rebbe says so often, we don't act, you and I, we don't act because we say, let someone else do it. And we excuse ourselves by saying, there are people much more qualified than I. I'm not a Moses. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a this. I'm not a that. I'm not a leader. I'm not a formally appointed leader, right? So let someone else take care of it. The Rebbe says, look at Pinchas. He saw wrong. He took care of business, right? Taking care of business and working overtime. And that's it. He gets it done. Who was he to do it? he was the guy to do it. That's it. So what's the moral of the story, or what's one lesson, another lesson from the story is, don't look to anyone else. Don't wait for anyone else. If something needs to be done and you know about it, take care of it. If you see something, say something. If you see something, do something. Don't blame someone else. When I say blame, I mean don't push it off on someone else. It's easy. It's easy to deflect. Who am I? That's where what we call false humility comes in, right? Suddenly everyone's humble. Who am I to do it? Who am I? I'm nothing. I'm like the dust of the earth. Suddenly you're nothing. Of course, right? It's convenient humility. So rather we should recognize, no, if God put us in this place at this time with this opportunity, and it doesn't only have to be, you know, rallying against an evil. Let's talk about a positive way. Let's say there's a mitzvah. There's an opportunity to do a mitzvah. Why should we push it off on someone else? Let's say we know a good cause. Yeah, we'll talk about tzedakah. A good cause. Why should we tell ourselves, well, there are people with bigger pockets they certainly can support. Maybe that's also true. But why shouldn't we step up as well? We shouldn't push things off on the other person. We should, if it's good and we know about it and we have the opportunity, we should step up and do it. This is the lesson, one of the lessons from Pinchas. Make sense? Yes? Carpe diem. Seize the day. But more than seize the day, seize the moment, seize the opportunity. Okay. Good. I want to share some more. Oh yeah, Karen, go ahead.
Wasn't, you know, like legacied into priesthood, because I thought that when Moses anointed Aaron, I thought that his descendants were effectively anointed into priesthood, into perpetuity. And the other thing is that doesn't that kind of conflict with the fact that a Kohen, a child, can deem someone pure or impure from Tazria,
right?
You know, without any kind of blessing from God, you know, just because they're a Kohen. So I'm like totally I'm stunned that Pinchas wasn't just due to his lineage.
Right. No, excellent question. So he basically fell through the cracks. As I said before, so what happened was, Aaron was appointed as a Kohen. His sons were appointed as Kohanim, directly from God. And then all those born into the family from that point on would be born in as Kohanim. But Pinchas was the grandson that had already been born. So he wasn't directly appointed, because it was only the father, Aaron, and his sons. So he wasn't directly appointed. It wasn't as a grandson. He wasn't directly appointed by God. And it was only those born in the family from that point on, and he was already born. So he missed that.
Okay, let's just say he was a little boy then during Tazria. He still was a Kohen and was able to deem somebody pure or impure.
No, he wasn't a Kohen. He was not a Kohen. He was in that family, but he was not a Kohen. His father was a Kohen. His grandfather was a Kohen. His younger brothers, born after that point in time, theoretically would have been Kohanim. But
so
he would not.
Those little boys would have been able to, if they were born afterwards, they would have had
Yes, they would have that. So anyone born from that point on, so when they from when they established a tabernacle, essentially, right? Anyone born into the family from that point on would be born into the priesthood. And anyone who was appointed a priest. But Pinchas wasn't appointed, and he wasn't born into it afterwards. So he missed it.
Talk about being the middle child.
Yeah, talk about a complex. I mean, I've no shock that he's carrying around swords. I'm kidding about that. Yeah. So look, but he was in that thing. By the way, you should know that's also why the commentaries point. That's why. Say the commentaries, the Torah traces his lineage. The Torah says, who was Pinchas? Ben Elazar, Ben Aaron HaKohen. He was the son of it. Why? To tell us that he didn't just act on his own zealotry. It wasn't like he was a hothead looking for a fight. You know, some people are very zealous, but they're always very zealous. They're always the ones to, like, you know, rage out about something, you know, righteous indignation, and you know who they are, right? It's always the same people, and you wonder, is it really for the cause, or are they just looking for a rumble? You know, and you have to be careful, because if that's your personality, not you specifically, I'm saying, if that's one's personality, then the question is it really for the cause, or is it really for themselves? The Torah, by tracing his lineage twice, at the end of last week's Torah portion, when it first introduces him, it says the same. It does the same, Pinchas, Ben Elazar, Ben Aaron HaKohen. It traces the lineage three generations, or two more above him. It does the same thing now, a few verses later, and the question that all the commentaries are wondering is, well, we know this, why is it doing that? And the answer that the commentaries, as the commentaries point out, Rashi points out, is because there were those who said, he's a hothead. Oh, he did a holy act? He's a hothead. In fact, his grandfather on the other side was Yisro, Jethro, who used to fatten the animals before the slaughter, to serve up juicy animals for idol worship. Remember, he was an idolater beforehand. Jethro was, Moshe's father-in-law. Whatever. The bottom line is, they were. There was a rumor that, yeah, this guy, you know, the cynics were saying, Pinchas, a holy act. Are you kidding me? He's looking for a fight. So the Torah says he wasn't looking for a fight. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. His grandfather was a peace-loving individual. He was also peace-loving. He wasn't looking for it. But he loved his brothers more than his, well, I don't know. I don't know how to end that sentence. He basically loved his brothers to the point that he was willing to do whatever it took to stop them from dying, 24,000 dying in a plague. Again, it's a simple example. Somebody defending their home. So they're not a violent person, but if it comes to that, they'll do what it takes to defend their family. Why? Not because they're looking for a fight, but because they love their family. Self-defense. The Torah says somebody comes up to, God forbid, kill a person, they're allowed to kill first. Self-defense. I mentioned it earlier in a different context. Permission for self-defense. Yeah? Why? Because you love your life. You love your family. You loved your loved ones, so you're going to defend your life. You're not looking for it, but if it happens, you're going to do it. Pinchas was the same way. That's where the Torah traces lineage to tell us that he didn't do so from a place of anger, a place of, you know, he was a hothead, you know, whatever it is. I'm just smiling now because it says in the Talmud, there are different traits. It says, actually, if you're a redhead, so you're more, that's what it says, by nature, you're more angry. I don't know, angry. It says you're more
Fiery,
passionate. It says passionate. So it says it could manifest theoretically as anger, but it could also manifest in other ways. The Talmud says if you're a redhead or born under maybe some certain constellation that's also associated with red and whatever, the same type of passion. So it says be a shochet, be a ritual slaughterer, be a moel, be a circumciser. Yeah. Find a way, find an outlet, right? To channel it in a positive way. But the point here is that Pinchas was not that. He was not like, you know, a zealot, always looking for a fight, always the first guy in the scrap, and here's another example. He wasn't like that. He was Ben Elazar, Ben Aaron HaKohen. That was his personality. Aaron, who was peace and love, who was always trying to bring people together, that was his personality. The fact that he did this means that it was very serious. It means that there was absolutely no other way. And the fact that he did it, even though others weren't acting, Moshe didn't do anything, tells us the lesson that I mentioned before about the importance of stepping up to the plate, even though we can excuse ourselves and justify ourselves by saying, well, no one else is doing it. Okay. Take a look. Let me share my screen one more time. Let's see if something else that I wanted to mention here. There's a census done right after the plague. Numbers chapter 26. One of the reasons, by the way, that the book of Numbers is called Numbers is because there are multiple times the Jewish people are counted. Here's another time that they're counted. It was after the plague that God spoke to Moses and to Elazar. Remember, Aaron passed away by now, so Elazar took over as the high priest. So now God spoke to Moses and Elazar, and he said, take a census. Census 2020. Take a census of the people from 20 and up, etc. And the census rolls on. I'm just going to mention this very quickly. In the second reading, which is connected with Monday, with today, so we have the census, starting with Reuben, and it goes to Shimon, Simeon, it goes to Gad. We have the full count. The bottom line count, 601,730. Men 20 to 60, only men 20 to 60, military age, right? So this is a new generation, it's after the 40 years. The previous generation has died out. It's after the plague that just happened, now the 24,000 that died. So total now is 601,730. Okay. One other point that I want to mention, and then we'll close it out, is in the counting of the family of Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, so it mentions Dathan and Abiram, who were part of the uprising of Korach. And it talks about how, it just kind of recaps the story. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them in Korach, alive. Fire destroyed the 250 men. When we're counting the tribes, the Torah points out, by the way, some are missing because some ended up swallowed by the earth. Okay, but verse 11 is fascinating. Korach's sons, however, did not die. And for this, I need to share Rashi. Do this very quickly. Look at verse 11. Korach's sons did not die. Look at this right here. They were originally involved in the conspiracy, but during the dispute, they contemplated repentance. Therefore, an elevated area was set apart for them in Gehinnom, and they stayed there. Listen to this. The earth opened up. The people involved fell in. They somehow ended up on a perch inside the bowels of the earth. They didn't fall all the way down. They had an elevated area. We would call it an overlook, right? Scenic overlook of Gehenna, of this purgatory that the others fell into, this living purgatory the others fell into. And there they stayed there until ultimately, according to the Medrash and the Talmud, they climbed out and came back into the community. They literally came back and, you know, dug themselves out and came through once again. And the Rebbe points out something really powerful. As Rashi says, we just read it, they were part of the original conspiracy. At the last minute, they had a change of heart, and because of that, they were spared. The Rebbe says, look at the power of a change of heart, or look at the power of an intention, right? A thought or a feeling. Even at the last moment, as the earth was swallowing them in, they're like, oh no, this was a bad idea. And they were spared. They regretted it. And because they regretted it, it's like a roller coaster. Why did I do this? As you go that, no, not that. That's not as bad. So at the last moment, they regretted it. Because of that, they were spared. And that's the power of even a thought or a feeling of teshuva, of repentance. We're doing a course now on the afterlife, and I've been asked, not in the class, but offline, people have been asking me, you know, are there people who have no hope? Like people that, you know, are eternally, you know, done for? Does Judaism believe that everyone's soul can be repaired? So, it's an interesting question. But one thing that I was thinking about, which I didn't necessarily answer to people that were asking, but it's something that I was thinking about that fits into today's context, is how do we know under what conditions somebody is going out? Right? On the inside. How do we know? Yeah? Somebody seems to be a bad person. Yeah? The power of tshuva is a person can, if they sincerely regret, and of course make amends on some level, at least, you know, on the human level, then tshuva is available. Okay. How do we know that in the last moments a person didn't make amends with themselves, with God, to whatever extent they could? Obviously not to the people, if they're not gathering all the people there, but on some level make amends. And on some level that wouldn't be, how do we know that that wouldn't be a repair, a tikkun for the soul? a repair for the soul. In other words, we don't know what's going on inside. What we do know is what the Torah documents. Uvnei Korach lo mesu. The sons of Korach did not die. The Torah itself says that. And it points that out to point out the power of teshuvah. Not teshuvah that was made public display with a bullhorn or with a megaphone or, you know, an op-ed or an ad in the New York Times, but something that only happened in their own hearts that spared them from death and from Gehenna. And eventually they came out. In fact, there are psalms. King David wrote psalms. Livnei Korach Mizmer Shir. Songs of the sons of Korach. It's the greatest hits. Anyway, it's a thing. The power of tshuva. The power of a thought. One thought to change your life. One thought can change your life. One thought does change our lives. Just one thought. So never underestimate the power of one thought, one good intention, one good feeling. All right, that's it for today. So what do we speak about? A lot of things. Pinchas. We spoke about the power of simple individuals. We spoke about the power of strength in peace, having a backbone to defend what you believe in. And of course, we spoke about the power of teshuvah, even if no one else knows. All right, any questions, comments?
Hi. Ari, I'd like to share one thing in my notes.
Sure.
It's not Rashi, but it's notes on the Rashi.
Okay.
From Megillah, whatever that is. I guess it's Talmud.
Talmud Tractate Megillah, yeah.
It says that it's not clear why Scripture would state when the sons of Korach did not die. If they did not participate in the sin of their father, it is obvious that they would not die because of it.
Right.
If they did participate in the sin, why should they not die?
Right, either way, it doesn't make sense. If they were not involved, then they're not in the conversation. If they were involved, then why didn't they die?
So Rashi explains that they did sin, but they had thoughts of repentance. Because of their thoughts of repentance, the earth beneath them became hard, and the spot intended for them in Gehenna, and thus they were spared. Alternatively, verse 10 of the sons of Korach lived. The phrase did not die implied that they neither lived nor died, but rather they existed in abeyance in a high place of Gehenna. This because their repentance was not complete. They merely had thoughts of repentance in their heart.
Right, excellent. The Rebbe speaks about this, and the Rebbe says, I mean, that's probably one commentary. The Rebbe says the fact that they were swallowed, right, and they survived, but underground, indicates it's midah keneged midah. It's appropriate to what on the outside it looked like they died. On the inside, they were spared, just like their involvement in the conspiracy. On the outside, they were involved. On the inside, they had regrets. Because the regret was only on the inside, therefore their sparing was only on the inside, if that makes sense. Right? So on appearances, it looked like they were involved and they were punished in the same way. On the outside. On the inside, they changed their mind. And their fate got changed as well. But my understanding, we have to look back at the sources, that eventually, at least according to some opinions, they eventually did climb out and they got married. They had kids, if I'm not mistaken. That was the end of the story, at least according to some. Their soul was saved, exactly. Which is a happy ending to the story. But again, it's all about us. I mean, you know, we're meant to take a lesson about us. And the lesson is, let's not underestimate. First of all, we should be less judgy of people, right? We shouldn't think that we know everything that person is all about, because we have no idea what's going on inside a person, number one. I didn't mention that. I should have mentioned that before. Right? That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is, it's a message of hope. That's it. I mean, it doesn't sound so positive the way I'm saying it. It's never too late. No, I don't mean that. But I mean, there's never underestimate the power of a good intention, even just within your own heart, within your own mind. All right, that's it for today. More exciting Torah discussion tomorrow. I can't wait to see you guys.
What about tonight, though? Isn't there an event tonight?
Yes, Healing the Divide. Yes, Healing the Divide in conversation with three individuals, community leaders from different segments of Brooklyn, different racial backgrounds and religious, spiritual backgrounds that are going to speak about their efforts in healing Crown Heights, Brooklyn after the Crown Heights riots. Big, 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 big. Very volatile moment in the early 90s. And these individuals were able to bring healing between the communities and dialogue. They've been working ever since on creating dialogue, and they're going to be speaking about their successes, what's worked in bringing together religions and races, and lessons for us today in what we're working through as a society collectively together. So it's going
to
be pretty.
Is it too late to sign up?
No, not at all. No, sign up now. I actually haven't sent out the email with the information yet. So those that are signed up, if you're wondering, I didn't get the login information. I didn't send it yet, just because I haven't sent it. I'm sending it in the next hour or two. So you can sign up. It's free. And join us. Be part of the conversation.
Through the original email or go to...
Yeah, you can go to the website. It's all on the website. It's intownjewishacademy.org/healing. H-E-A-L-I-N-G. intownjewishacademy.org/healing. And then you can find it. You sign up. Put your name down, and then I'm sending out an email with login information to all those that I have in the list. All right, good. Some events, just so you know, some events we have to. It's hard. It's remember we had an some events. It's not wise to put out the login information directly on social media, but rather to require people to put at least their name and email down. That's the reality of the world we live in, especially at an event like this, given what happened a few weeks ago in our class. So anyway, so that's it. So just put your name down and we'll get you in. And spread the word. If you know anybody, and this is for everybody, if you know anybody that would appreciate this, whether from Atlanta or from elsewhere, let them know about it. It's going to be pretty powerful. Okay, see you soon. Hope to see you soon. Take care, all. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Yes, all right.